The Radio Book Club is supported by the Read Alaska Award Program at Fireside Bookstore in downtown Palmer.
Hello and welcome to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio 89.5. I'm Judy Getty and I will be hosting the show today as we discuss America's Women, 400 Years of Dolls, Drudges, Helpmates, and Heroines by Gail Collins. Joining me is Dana Stabenow by telephone in Palm Springs, California. Good morning or afternoon to you, Dana.
Hi.
And also Deborah Guidosh from Public Health Services. Hello, and thank you for joining me.
Hi, Judy.
So before we get started, I want to remind our listeners that typically you can call in during a live broadcast, but we are not taking calls today. So we're hoping that you will be listening and maybe even submit comments online later. So as we start to talk about this book, I think the first thing most people will recognize is that, holy smokes, did we miss a lot of history when we took classes in high school and elementary school. Would you guys agree?
Almost definitely.
I would absolutely agree. I was just, you know, I read this book quite some years ago, and I've been thumbing through it again, looking at all my notes and marginal notations and highlighting some stuff like that. It's not just, you know, what we missed in class. It's what we missed if we read history for fun. You know, I've read a lot about World War II, and I found myself reading through the World War II section of this book again about what happened to American women during World War II. You know, they were reviled when they tried to join the Army. The pilots, the American pilots, male pilots, organized Congress so that the WASP would be disbanded, what the nurses went through on baton, and then later imprisonment, and they wouldn't even, you know, they wouldn't even allow them to be buried with a flag draped over their coffin. They wouldn't allow that the head of those marvelous nurses on baton to receive the third highest award for valor that our country gives. It's enraging all over again how much I missed and how much they missed.
And certainly part of my experience was I was not even aware of the role that women played to the extent that they did until I was a young woman myself in college and decided to take an elective course, Women's Lives. And that's when I was first introduced to Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, and then, you know, read about their contributions and how their contributions up through the ages had allowed me to have some of the freedoms that I enjoyed as a young woman in the 60s and 70s. But it's certainly not lacking in our K-12 system even today to a great extent. You have to kind of go to college to find this out.
And I think, you know, you mentioned being enraged as you read it. And I think that's the other thing, you know, we can sort of reflect on is just the emotions that it brings out. Sometimes you're amused, sometimes you're truly enlightened, and sometimes you really are just dang angry about how women were treated.
I just can't believe how badly people acted. How could they go home and look themselves in the mirror after that? I find it astonishing. And maybe I'm bringing, you know, the sensibility of my time to the regard of those times, but nevertheless, it's very, very infuriating.
Yes.
And upsetting.
So one of the things Collins talks about in the introduction is that she wants to make this point about the duality of women's roles throughout our history. And so, Dana, you brought up World War II, and one of the things that I noted was that when women were allowed to fly the planes, one of the jobs was, of course, to transport planes to different areas where the male pilots were going to need them. But the other thing they did was they pulled targets so that the gunners could practice shooting at targets, you know, which was obviously pretty dangerous if these guys were not very good at their job. But then the other part of that was that they couldn't leave the base at night in slacks.
Well, how about that WASP crew that got grounded in Alabama, and the cops arrested them? They got grounded due to, I think it was bad weather in Alabama, and the cops arrested them for being out on the street in slacks. They wouldn't listen to them. They, you know, that they were pilots, that they were women pilots, that they were serving officers in the Army at that time. How about that?
appalling.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just, it's almost unbelievable. If, you know, you didn't know it was true, you would think, oh, come on, this has got to be a story, but it's not.
So Collins divides the book into chapters that are chronological, and you know, that would be one way to discuss the book, is, you know, going through the different time periods, but that might be kind of onerous and keep us from being so spontaneous in this discussion. So I thought we'd just talk about some different topics. And I don't know why I picked marriage, but I picked that one first. So one of the things that kind of struck my interest with her topic of marriage was the tobacco wives. So this is early on in our colonial days, and we didn't have enough women over here in America, and so they were trying to get women to come over. And so these women would come over, and they were called tobacco wives.
Well, they were essentially indentured servants to some extent. And they came over, and they were, their worth was, I think it was 120 pounds of good leaf tobacco. So that was the monetary worth of the women that came over to be married. And then it evolved to where women were actually kidnapped and brought over against their will to the new country, or else they were given a choice. You can go to prison, or you can go over to be a tobacco bride, I think they were called. And they had very little say into much of what they were able to do and not able to do, and they were really under the thumb of whoever they married. And the master could be quite cruel. I was very surprised to read that a woman could stay in this indentured servitude, and even her child can, if the debt was not paid off, which I thought was astounding. So let's call it what it was, slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yes, that's exactly what it was.
Well, and there's some ups and downs in I think what Collins portrays is, you know, the demand for women to marry. And, you know, there's certainly, I would say, the majority of the time, there was a lot of pressure on women to marry. Women often married very young. There was the, you know, even in the 60s, one of the articles in a magazine was about women, and they all expected to marry by the age of 22. And mm-hmm. I believe that has gone up since then. But, you know, this incredible pressure to marry. And in the colonial days, again, women were expected to marry and then marry again if a husband died, and marry again if that one died. And they were, you know, referred to those as serial marriages.
And in Salem in 1693, if you didn't marry, again, there was a period there where you might have been burned at the stake. Well, hanged by the neck anyway.
Well, yes. Yes. So, yeah, along with that idea that, well, some of the belief was that they were doing that in order to get the property that those women had. But, you know, that's another thing that people oftentimes don't realize, that married women didn't have property rights. Mm-hmm. And so when they married, they would become one, and the one was the man. And so they would lose all their right to their property. So a lot of women, especially if they were widowed and they were property owners, they would not want to marry again.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly tried. It was interesting that they tried to protect their property by getting some type of legal documentation, which I thought when reading that, well, smart girl. And the only way that they could move up in society is if they did marry someone else at a higher standard in life. So as they were widowed, then they would get the next best guy, and then they would get their status from that, or only if they were widowed and then had property, and then they were able to have some power. But they would have to give up the idea of getting married in order to have this position of power. And I think that message continues throughout the book, even to contemporary times for women. They have to give something up in order to have some power, because we've found out that it's very difficult to have it all.
Yes.
Yeah. And even later on, like, you know, I'm thinking about the story about Harriet Hubbard Ayer in 1886. She started a cosmetics business that was so successful, her husband and daughter, that's what gets mm-hmm. me, conspired to have her committed to an asylum so they can take over the business. So even if you had property, even, you know, it sometimes it just didn't even really matter. If you were a woman and you were powerful and you started your own business, it automatically, oftentimes, made you a target.
Yes.
And certainly the hegemony of the time allowed the oppression of women. So it was an okay thing to do. So nobody really thought of it as being overly problematic until someone spoke up about it. But they were in the minority on that in that regard. Even women saw that as being okay to be under the yoke of their father and then their husband to some extent. And it was only when the movement to change that became more in vogue or more the women became more vocal about it, did they start saying, hey, this is not really very good, besides their own feeling or their own little group that they talked about this.
Mm-hmm. And I think, again, looking at what Collins calls this duality, and so we think in terms of, you know, women were supposed to marry so that they would be protected and so that they would, you know, have a home. And I guess that romanticized kind of idea that now your life will be good here on out. And the observations about how hard these women worked. I mean, unless you were from the few well-to-do families, these women worked hard. And the one thing that I noted, too, was that out west, so this would have been like in the 1800s, the observation of even in the Native American and the Mexican relationships that the white people would comment on how hard the women worked. And the one quote was, women are the slaves to the men obliged to maintain them with the sweat of their brow. And I thought maybe that white guy had noticed it in other cultures, but I wonder if he noticed it in his own.
Yeah, that was the interesting thing about that. Each different ethnicity would be able to point out how hard the women worked, but they weren't able to see it in their own culture. They recognized it in others.
And I can't put my finger on the, I'm scrabbling through the book, and I can't put my finger on the passage. But do you remember the passage? The working conditions, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. You know, they're in these smoke-filled houses. There's no glass in the windows. There's maybe some oiled skin or scraped oiled paper or scraped skin, and they're having to do all their sewing and all their close, you know, work by the light of either the fireplace. And they would sometimes set themselves and their work on fire because they were leaning so close to the fire in the fireplace to see what they were doing, or they're over by the window in the winter, you know, what little light gets through the oiled paper or the scraped skin so that they can do their needlework. You know, I'm going to think about quilting in a whole different way from now forward.
Yeah, and our leisure time too, right? Because they certainly didn't have any of that.
Plus all the rest of their family responsibilities still continued onward. It wasn't like, well, they're doing this work now, so everything else has to be put on hold. They still had to continue to take care of the family and do everything that they needed, plus all of this other work that they had to get done as well. So they were tough. Women were very, very tough. And reading that, even looking at all the hardships that they had, I had still a sense of pride that no matter what, they were tough. And they were able to get through some really horrible situations and many times rise above it.
Nicely put. I think giving them credit, too, for oftentimes taking over their husbands' roles if the husbands died or the husbands were off, you know, hunting or attending to other, what they called business.
They were going to war. Yes.
Yes, they're going to war. So they were there always covering, you know, everything that needed to be done, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very, very grateful for my life today.
So I want to remind our listeners, this is Radio Book Club on 89.5, and we're discussing America's Women by Gail Collins. Let's shift our conversation to pregnancy and birth control. I know this is another topic near and dear to all our hearts. So, you know, just along the lines even of what we're talking about, that women initially didn't have control over their own reproduction. And so oftentimes just, you know, having baby after baby after baby and with the expectation that many of them would die.
Mm-hmm. And that was their lot in life. That was happened, and it was unfortunate and sad, but that's the way it went. And certainly when we talked about Margaret Sanger on one of the other broadcasts, she certainly was able to see that up close and personal through her work, some of her nursing work in New York, and saw how the poor were really suffering through this, most especially because those with means had access to information about birth control and even some forms of contraception. I think the big thing was the medicalization of childbirth that really was very detrimental to the health and well-being of women when doctors
came in. When Margaret Sanger opened up the first shop to sell birth control with her sister, Ethel Byrne, right, Judy?
Yes.
I recently saw someone took a photograph of that day, and there were women lined up around the corner and down the block, many of them with lots of kids hanging off their hands. And, you know, before the police hustled in and arrested them for obscenity because, you know, it was against the Comstock law and at that time. That was an eye-opener for me as well. I never saw that photograph before. That ought to be required viewing, I think, for probably every woman in the land, if not the world.
I teach very young students at the college, and you know, I teach an introduction to gender and women's studies. And when these young women discover that, you know, how long it took to get birth control, something they just take for granted, and that it wasn't until the 70s that, or the 60s, late 60s, early 70s maybe, when it was legal for unmarried women to obtain it. I mean, they're just they're just stunned that that is, seems like such recent history.
And in my work in public health, when I have young women come in and they're starting on an oral contraceptive pill, and I'm giving them counseling on how to take it and the side effects and the ups and the downs of it, I open up the pill with great majesty and say, open the packet with majesty and say, and every time you take one of these pills, you can thank Margaret Sanger. And they say, who's Margaret Sanger? And I have a chance to teach.
There you go. Learning opportunity. Yes. So the other thing that you touched on, Deb, is the medicalization of childbirth. And I think, you know, I suppose there's some positive aspects of this. But in some ways, you know, when we kind of picture that scene of a woman in labor and she's surrounded by her neighbors and women who care about her and the, you know, the official midwife, I just get more of a picture of people who are supportive and caring, and it's very individual kind of treatment.
Well, certainly childbirth was looked at from those perspectives of the midwives as natural. And because it was natural, the pregnant woman was allowed to go through the stages of labor as her body dictated, as opposed to rushing it along or using forceps. Although there were times, too, where the midwives had difficulties with someone with a very small pelvis and a very large baby. And, you know, they did have some of their struggles as well. But looking at the medicalization, the physicians, which was with all aspects of women's health, looked at all stages of development of a woman's life from menstrual cycle to childbearing to perimenopause to menopause as disease. And this is a natural aspect of growth and development in a young woman. So it made a different view as women having something wrong with them, as opposed to this is the natural stages of your life.
They had that's another thing that incensed me about World War II. Even as late as World War II, you know, the men are looking for any excuse whatsoever, particularly the establishment, the people who are running things, to get the wasps out of the air. And first they try to say that, oh, you know, a woman is not going to be an effective pilot when she's having her period. And, of course, a doctor writes this comprehensive study that says that's a bunch of baloney. And so, okay, they're defeated on that. Then they decide that women are going to be, you know, once they get the disease of menopause, they are also no longer able to fly. I mean, any excuse will do. Any way to define women as other and, like you say, diseased, the natural course of their life. You know, when we're afflicted by one disease after another, evidently, something I did not know before.
And unfortunately, some of that those thought patterns are in contemporary times. If you think about the political statements about women and rape and contraception, it's with us today. We haven't moved that far from that.
No, those attitudes are not that long gone, not gone at all in some respects,
When you mentioned earlier, Deb, about, we have to admire the strength of these women, and I think in another conversation earlier we had talked about thinking about these women, and when we talked about, you know, out on the prairie, kind of the picture you drew, Dana, or, you know, working the jobs their husbands have left, or they already have children, and they're, you know, sewing, and they're cooking, and they're making their own soap, and they're tilling the fields and all of that while they're pregnant. So, you know, all of that and you're pregnant. So, incredible amount, I would think, of physical strength and mental strength.
A little bit of the other side of that coin that I was also very interested to read is that when it became possible, at least in the original 13 colonies, to go and buy made products where you didn't have to make things anymore, then women's value to the household was devalued, I guess, is the word, because they weren't needed anymore to make soap and to sew quilts because they could go purchase them. And I thought that was a really interesting observation as well. I mean, as much as they worked their fingers to the bone and probably went blind making quilts, when they couldn't do that, when they didn't have to do that anymore, it wasn't necessarily a benefit.
Well, I think they always found more work for him to do.
Yes, yes.
Sweep more dirt out of the house.
Well,
now you have extra money and you have little, you know, objects to dust more. So, well, let's also mention, Collins does a pretty good job, I think, of covering the pre-Civil War days. And so certainly for the women, African-American slaves, their experiences in childbirth were a whole nother story, because of course they oftentimes worked right up until the moment that they had to that they gave birth, and that was probably working very hard in the fields and didn't own or have possession of their child, so to speak, that they could lose their children not only to illness and disease, but being yanked away from them and sold.
Mm-hmm.
What I found interesting in reading about African American women was that the maternal mortality rate was lower as against white women, but the infant mortality rate was higher. And Collins discusses how perhaps it was because African American women were more physically active. They didn't have the constrictions of the types of clothes that white women wore, that who were proper with the corsets and all the other stuff. They just wore these little, what I can gather from the book, these little sacks that they wore, and they did physical labor. So they were healthier, and they had a greater health outcome as a result of that. But because they didn't get prenatal care, they didn't have care of the newborn, and many times the mothers had to leave the newborns to be, you know, taken care of by young children or very elderly, that the infants didn't do as well because there wasn't attention to them. And because of their work related to the fields, they had to wean the babies prior to the babies really needing to be weaned. So it's really the infants paid the price once they were born. And I found that a very interesting juxtaposition when we looked at what happened to the white women in the same circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing that I like about this book is that you're given a lot of history, you're given a lot of information, but I really like the stories that she tells of individual women. And so I made a few notes, just of, you know, some that we've heard of and some that we've never heard of. So, you know, she must have just poured through tons of information to come up with all of these. So most people have heard of Amelia Earhart, an aviator, and she was the first woman to fly across the Atlantic solo in 1932. And she disappeared in 1937 with her navigator when she was trying to circumnavigate the world. But never heard of Bessie Coleman, an African-American pilot. And she wanted to go to pilot school in America, but of course they would not allow her. And so she went to Paris after World War I and became a pilot and worked as a stunt pilot. And then, you know, the rest of the story that Collins tells us is she fell to her death in a rollover, and I assumed that was a stunt she was doing and was not seatbelted in. So any stories that, you know, people that jumped out for you two individual women?
Well, I was sensible of the all the stories of the women that I had never heard of before. I mean, I was almost overwhelmed because it's on every page. They're not just thrown in there for effect either. They support what, you know, Collins is a very able journalist, and every story that she cites supports whatever point she is trying to make. Yay for her. She's really good at her job. But how about, you know, I find out that it's not just women I haven't heard of before. It's stuff about women I have heard about before. Like Eleanor Roosevelt's secret FBI file eventually reached 4,000 pages. Seriously? I, first of all, maybe this is really naive of me, but I didn't even know that J. Edgar Hoover had a file on Eleanor Roosevelt. But that it's 4,000 pages long. Just feels like 4,000 miles. I found myself stuck on that, reading that sentence over and over a couple of times, and rereading the passages about Eleanor Roosevelt and the Society of Sisters that she created in government. That also was new to me. I was astounded by that and so admiring of that. And then wondering where that went in the 50s and the 60s, you know, in the post-World War II years. That also was completely new to me and totally unexpected. I was really blown away by that.
Well, I'm sure J. Edgar had files on everybody he didn't like.
Yeah, evidently,
and certainly an intelligent woman would be somebody he would certainly decide to start a file on. But, you know, I was thinking while you were talking, Dana, about the Eleanor, is that she was, you know, the first lady. And it will be interesting to see when we have a female president, if the stories about the first, what are we going to call him, the first gentleman, the first husband, will be as lacking in depth and comprehensiveness when it's the man who is the not the president of the United States. Of course, I think women, the first ladies, were kind of like helpmates, and they had their little projects that they did. But it'll be interesting to see if that changes.
I will be very interested to see that for many respects.
So I just recently finished a biography of Frances Perkins, and Deb and I and several other women played different historical figures for National Women's History Month last weekend. And so I was Frances Perkins, so I had to do quite a bit of research on her. So the friendship she had with Eleanor was very, very close. And, of course, actually, she had met FDR first and was friends with him. But, you know, she was also very much maligned within the country for being a woman and, you know, what was considered a man's job. FDR really, you know, had to stand up for putting a woman in a position of power, having her as Secretary of Labor. And he backed most of her ideas. And she seemed to be very influential in going to him and persuading him to do the things that she wanted to accomplish, like Social Security and increasing
one of
wages.
One of the things I loved about Fran, I hated it, but I loved it, but she was so pragmatic and realistic. One of the first things she did was start dressing in older women's clothing, long, dark dresses, because it seemed she would get a better response dealing with men on these issues if she did look like an older woman.
Looked like their mother. yes.
Yeah, she totally had to basically de-sex herself, you know. That essentially is what she was doing. She turned herself into a crone. And that's one of the reasons she probably put down to, you know, the fact that she was so incredibly effective. And I also, Collins, but do you remember the passage where Collins says that when Perkins went into her office, that her predecessor had left a desk full of cockroaches behind for her and had left her no instructions as to, you know, no list of contacts or any, you know, helpful advice behind? And Collins doesn't name him, and I was so annoyed at that I went and looked him up, and I just want to name him on the air. William Doak, that's who did it.
There, you just outed him, okay.
I did. I totally outed him, and I'm proud to say it.
Well, and even though, you know, she dressed so that the men would think of her as maternal, that she actually lied about her age, and she always gave her age as 2 years younger. So, you know, in the biography about her, it talked about how when she was working at the age of what was believed to be 70, she was actually 72 and was supposed to have been retired by then. So, yes, she was pretty wily. Okay. So we're going to take a brief break and go to a station identification.
You are listening to KVRF FM, Radio Free Palmer. We are an all-volunteer station. New volunteers are welcome. Email us at manager@radiofreepalmer.org or call 745-8951. Big Cabbage Radio welcomes your help.
Okay, we're back, and we're talking about America's Women by Gail Collins. You know, I'm talking about women who use their age, either pro or con, I guess, but Mother Jones, who was Mary Harris from Cork, Ireland, and so most people know her as Mother Jones, but she was very involved in the labor wars in the early 1900s. And so she would dress like an older woman and to take on that persona and you know, again, trying to get respect from people. But she just seemed like such a no-nonsense person, you know, that if the men were balking about, a labor issue or a work stoppage or something, and they were afraid of going to jail, she just would let them know how many times she'd been in jail and kind of shame them into taking some action.
What I liked about... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Deb.
What I liked about her was that she was... identified as an equal opportunity organizer. And she would also organize African-American workers and their family and the women and the children as well. And that was something that was really lacking, because I noticed that reading through this book, there, as much as there was a celebration of women, there still maintained a class system. And even with my beloved ladies of Seneca Falls, they still did not have an inclusive attitude for the rights of African American women. But Mother Jones did not do that. And so that was the greatest distinction I took away from her, besides the fact that she was a fire-breathing dragon and really was a force to contend with. So I was like, you go, girl. And reading about her was that she must have been quite tough.
They all had to have been tough.
I just, you know, since you kind of touched on that, imagine trying to, you know, make some changes, make some progress, gain more rights, and you're butting up against, you know, for women, butting up against African-Americans trying to gain some rights. And so you have this whole conversation of, should we all band together? We would obviously be the majority against the minority white males, but they sort of felt it was an either or. One, you know, if one person was going to gain, the other one could not gain, which is just really unfortunate.
And any perceived victory by one party would probably be perceived as a loss by the other.
Yes.
Well, and that's what happens.
At least at first.
Mm-hmm. And that's certainly what happens is when political thinking usurps philosophical discussion. Because you have to figure out what's the lesser of two evils and what can we progress through. And we see that in politics today. You know, let's, you know, cut out food stamps in order to progress further in some other aspect that requires finances. So it's that was political thinking. But it was disappointing to me.
This is sort of on target. I don't know. You guys call me if it's off. One of the things that I came away from this book is, what is it about women that makes even heroes behave badly? I was heartbroken when I saw that Dr. King was unwilling to give credit to Rosa Parks, and even all the male leaders of the civil rights movement were unable or unwilling to credit the women's contributions, which were considerable and may even have been more than the men's contributions, but they're totally unsung. You know, and I mean, they're just deferred, they're set aside. One male civil rights leader actually told Rosa Parks, in refusing to allow her to speak at an event, "You have spoken enough." Really?
Yeah.
I like the quote that there wouldn't have been a Dr. King if there wasn't a Rosa Parks. That was one of my favorites. I said, that was beautiful.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, that was really lovely. Yes.
The other, I think,
not that anybody ever, you know, I mean, it's the first time I've ever read it. When, you know, you think that I would have seen that all over the place. And in this book, it's the first place I read it.
That the other thing I think that Collins does a good job of is, you know, as we're talking and we mentioned, you know, the emotional responses we have to stuff, she doesn't lead us one way or the other. You know, she just puts all the information out there as, here's the information. And, you know, kind of along the lines of what we're talking about, you know, I wrote down this one woman, Mary Chestnut, and she was the wife of a plantation owner, or I guess she would be considered the owner, in quotation marks too, prior to the Civil War. And so I tried to, you know, decide if I was sympathetic to those women or not, because, you know, we see all kinds of movie images of these women, and sometimes they may be sympathetic and sometimes not. And, you know, even this particular woman that she names, and includes several other examples, but Collins talks about how they disliked the institution of slavery, but they wanted the benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Dana,
I'm kind of referring to it as a necessary evil.
Right. And to maintain their lifestyle. And, you know, another book club Dana and I are in, we had a book recently we read about slavery, but this whole idea, you know, where were the plantation owners' wives thinking and knowing their husbands were fathering children with the slaves? You know, what was that like to live with?
Yes.
You know, so...
Thinking of it as, you know, I mean, oh, I don't want to be too sour. I mean, I don't want to be too sour about this book because in many respects it's a joyous book. It's you know, I know much more now about the history of my gender than I ever did before in my life. And I'm happy about that. And, you know, Collins has a terrific sense of humor, too. She's, you know, able to skewer with the best of them.
Mm-hmm.
But... God, yeah, I when I think about the women plantation owners, you know, and I wonder if they're, I don't even want to say this out loud. I wonder if they're reconciling themselves to the fact that the husbands are increasing their property while they're out, you know, impregnating the slave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't even like those words to cross my brain pan. I feel like I want to take bleach to my brain cells now.
Well, and again, I think that goes to that duality. So here are these women that are supposed to be living in high style, you know, that have very little to do. But again, they were running the plantations because their husbands were off and off doing other things. And so they also worked hard and having to live with that, you know, that situation in their home, too. So, yes, certainly another example of that.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I liked, too, was talking about women. And I think I mentioned this earlier about women who took over the jobs their husbands had. And I liked how it didn't even matter what the work was. So out west, there was a woman named Nellie Pooler Chapman who took over her husband's dental practice. So I'm guessing that dentists didn't have a lot of training anyway. You know, give them a shot of whiskey and get out the, you know, the pliers or something. Yes, and yank that tooth out. But I just love that. Well, he's dead. I guess I'll be the dentist now. And then the other example, Martha Maxwell, she supported herself and her daughter as a taxidermist. And you think, really? Was there a lot of call for that? Okay, I don't know.
Apparently so, that she made a living out of it. I thought, too, when Chapman took over as the dentist, I thought, well, I hope that she at least had some time as a dental assistant at some time in her husband's practice, that she knew where the tools were and how to use them. But there you go. I thought that was very amusing.
And then,
well, how about the gal who ran the stagecoach?
Right.
You know, and she wasn't even discovered to be a woman until her death.
Well, and you know, we can look at that throughout history too, where women oftentimes took maybe not oftentimes, but would choose to take on the clothing of men and pass as men in order to be able to do what they wanted and have that freedom,
or even protection.
There are a lot of stories, aren't there, about women, Southern women, who actually, you know, didn't want to leave their husbands and so dressed as men and fought beside them. Rita Mae Brown wrote a book about that,
mm-hmm.
I think. Yeah.
Okay.
It's pretty. You know, I truly do think that this book is a triumph because we made it. You know, we're here, so, and Collins was able to write this book, and we are able to be here on the radio, you know, talking about it. So all of these women's sacrifices and the abuse that they suffered and the indignities and the injustice, it wasn't in vain.
Right. And I tell my daughters and my students, we all stand on the shoulders of the women who came before us. Absolutely.
Right.
That they're that example for us.
And I think that Collins' writing hooks you right from the first or second paragraph when she's talking about the women who came over on the ships who were pregnant. And right away, it grabbed me. I said, I had a connection. These were my sisters. It immediately, mm-hmm. I cared about everyone I read about in that book because of the first few chapters that I read. And I can remember thinking, oh, my, how did they make that? Most especially because my daughter is so late in her pregnancy now. And I was thinking, how could she be on one of those ships? How could those poor women have gotten through that? And I was immediately bonded with them. And that's why I think this is a wonderful text for an introductory women's lives course, because the chapters really stand on their own. And you can really look at each chapter and look at that perspective from that social time and then really kind of get an understanding of what was going on. So I thought it was a wonderful book.
Well, you sound like you guys are done talking, and we're not done yet. So.
No.
Okay. So I just want to give one other example, because I just thought this was a funny story. And her name was Sarah Wilson, and she was an English citizen transported to the colonies as an indentured servant, as you know we talked about earlier, was certainly common. And in her case, it was because she should have gone to jail, but jails were very stuffed during this time. And so she was sent over to to America as an indentured servant as her punishment. And what she had done was she had stolen a jewel in the royal palace. And so she's an indentured servant, and she escapes from the people who, you know, have control over her. And she runs off to South Carolina and introduces herself as Queen Charlotte's sister, Princess Susanna Carolina Matilda. And I thought, who wouldn't want to know her? You know, she sounds like somebody who, you know, she'll come out on top every time. So
I hope she did.
And that certainly made me think that women were able to look at the situation they were in and say, okay, what are my choices? I could marry someone. I could be an indentured servant, even though I don't want to do that. What can I do to survive? And so women seem to always look at the situation, go, okay, what can I do? And this woman used her guile and her background, and I said, God bless her. Okay,
yeah.
She went through. Okay, girl, you did a good job.
There you are. Okay, let's switch up a little bit and talk about just the history of education for girls and women, because, of course, this is one where we've made some obvious strides in. During the colonial period, girls were not educated very much. They might get some writing and arithmetic skills, maybe music and dancing if they were from a well-to-do family. But obviously they were going to take care of the home and have babies, and so didn't have a lot of need for education.
Well, that certainly was evident in the early parts. Even Elizabeth Cady Stanton had received some education into how to take care of the house and to be a good wife, but her family was educated, and she was allowed to listen to the conversations when her family had friends over who were educated and also be educated alongside her brothers. So you had to be a family of means, and I would assume that from reading how women were educated in that period, that if you were like kind of like a middle class, then you were educated to take care of a family. And there really wasn't a concept that you would be educated to do anything else. It was just that you got lucky. You got collateral education.
Right. And, you know, another rare person was Elizabeth Blackwell. She was the first woman to graduate from American Medical School, and that was in 1849. And she pops up a lot in our history. Mm-hmm. So.
When I think about women in education, American women in education, I always think about Laura Ingalls Wilder. And, you know, one of my favorite parts in all of those, I think it's Little Town on the Prairie, when she and her friend Ida give the school exhibition and give the history of the world in two parts. I can't remember which one of them did the first part and one of them did the second part. And then all the parsing of the sentences and the mathematical problems that they have to do in their head. And it, and then she goes off to become a school teacher and will teach, you know, for $25. The entire term. That is, I mean, I know that there's a difference between dollars then and dollars now. But didn't I just read somewhere, I don't think in Collins, but that, you know, the point of educating all these women was so that you get cheap teachers.
But not initially, because, of course, it was a job that they wanted from men.
I'm talking about later in the
century. Yeah.
I'm talking about later in the century, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess my point is it changed so radically.
Oh, whatever was, at the time would benefit the people in power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was.
And any time, when you look back historically, when you look at opportunities for women, women always gained opportunities when there was war. Because the men were taken away, so then the women had to come in and take their place, and then they found another level that they could of skills that they could achieve. And certainly women continued to be chosen as teachers because they were cheaper. And even during the 50s, if you were being interviewed and you were a young woman who was married, and they would be able to ask you, do you plan to have children? Because then you would be able to be let go, because then, or not hired at all. And now, of course, mm-hmm. we know that's illegal to ask that question. But that was also another part, and that women's dispositions lent themselves to be better nurturers of young minds. And so that kind of was the schmoozy part of it. But the real underside, the dirty underbelly, was they were cheaper.
Mm-hmm. And at some point, not enough men to fill the positions. So it was expedient to put women in the jobs. And then, of course, they could always justify paying them less. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to... go ahead, Dana.
Well, okay. Did you have something else to say on this topic, Judy? I don't want to...
Well, just, you know, the other thing that, you know, women should be at home taking care of families, but that they also believed women, of course, were less intelligent. So that was an argument that to keep us out of all kinds of things. And I liked the quote from... Dr. Charles Meigs from 1847, he's given a speech at the Jefferson Medical College, and he says, "She has a head almost too small for intellect and just big enough for love."
Well, oh, God,
I can
yes,
thank goodness
I
we're good for something. Okay, go ahead. Change the topic.
Well, there was a thought that I wanted to get in before the end of the hour. And there were some revelatory thoughts in this book about prohibition. I've always thought about prohibition as being a moral quest on the part of the women who, you know, fueled it. That it was morally reprehensible to drink, and so they were going to remove that temptation from the general population by outlawing alcohol. And of course, it blew up in their faces and gave rise to organized crime. And I've always thought it was ridiculous. What I didn't know was that much of the underpinning of the impetus behind prohibition was the fact that alcohol was so cheap and so free and so easy to attain that so many men were drunks, and that the alcohol fueled abuse of women and children was much more the impetus behind prohibition than it was making a moral judgment on those who drank. That was revelatory to me. Mm-hmm. I had no idea.
And that the men's wages would go to the barkeep. So, yes.
Yeah,
I had heard that part, too, but I just had started thinking in terms of, you know, taking so long for women to get the vote. One of the reasons they were stalling women getting the vote, because they feared that when women had the vote, they would vote for prohibition. So it's just
the
so...
alcohol, the liquor industries were big supporters of the anti-woman vote because of that.
Yes. Yeah. And but what's so curious then is that, you know, prohibition actually came in before suffrage. So it's not our fault. Yeah. It wasn't our fault.
Right.
We weren't on duty for that one. So Deb, you mentioned, you know, that opportunities for women or I don't know, maybe Dana, you said it, that it was war that was really the pivotal times when women would be able to have new opportunities. And I guess what was revelatory to me was that, you know, we know about it in World War II, but during the Civil War that, you know, okay, I've heard about women wanting to be nurses. And of course, again, they're appalled. They don't want women out there in those field hospitals, seeing men naked and you know, anything like that, that their senses are too delicate for that. But that they worked in government jobs, that they were... you know, working in the Washington, D.C., in government positions, administrative, secretarial type things.
Are you talking about World War One or World War Two now?
Civil War, during the Civil War.
Oh, Civil War, right, yes.
Yeah, okay. So again, kind of surprising that women were out to work, and again, paid less. I think the page I looked at, women were paid $8 a month, whereas men were paid $11 for that position. But so an opportunity for them to go to work and an opportunity for... the employer to pay less.
I too was surprised at how early that was. I was not aware that women were in those positions during that wartime.
Mm-hmm.
But I said World War II and World War I could understand that's more familiar to me, but I was surprised by that, but not surprised that they made less.
Yeah.
You know, so much of this stuff is driven by economics. When in summation, I think it's either in the last chapter or the epilogue, when Collins writes about the great strides that the women's movement made in the 60s and 70s, really we had to do this as a nation because there were so many women now with degrees and advanced degrees that it would have been economically unfeasible not to put them to work, to ignore that economic potential. And you look back and you can really, most of this, much of this is driven by economics.
That's true.
And unfortunately, not by the moral compass.
No. It's all about the dollars and cents.
So in World War II, I guess the part that I wasn't aware of was that in, you know, getting women out to work to fill the jobs that men had vacated, the amount of guilt they would heap on women who could not go out to work for whatever reason. And then thinking again about here are these young women oftentimes with young children, and the government is doing this incredible propaganda campaign to get women to take these jobs. And at the same time saying, you know, you owe it to your country, you know, you taking this job saves a serviceman's life, giving zero assistance for childcare, zero. Yeah. It's like it never even occurred to anyone that these women were going to need to have someone take care of their children. And so the stories about tying children to tables so that when the mom left home, that the child would be safe, or, you know, leaving them places that were, you know, not safe. Did they talk about leaving them in cars and parking lots? And so, again, just with real disregard for what the women's needs were.
And certainly for that guilt to be placed upon them during the war and then to be so unceremoniously dumped immediately when war was over and men came back, and the expectation was go back into the kitchen as if nothing happened, and not being smart enough to know that a transformation did take place and that the pendulum can swing, but it never swings back all the way to where it was.
Well, oh, very well put.
Given that they had to enact a new law to send women back home, tells you that a lot of those women did not want to go back home.
Mm-hmm.
That was my take on it.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't do them any good. We busted out anyway.
Like she said, the pendulum swings, but couldn't go all the way back. So this is kind of a leap to a different topic, but it kind of relates when we think about how women had to dress. And, you know, we were talking about women going to work in the Civil War era even. And so the corsets, how they would be cinched up into the corset with the demand of a 20 or 21 inch waist, or maybe even smaller. What did Scarlett O'Hara have, like 19 inches, mm-hmm. something unfathomable. But again, they're doing all this work and they're wearing this incredible amount of clothing. For the Women's History Month event I was talking about earlier, we had a couple of young women come dressed as Lucy Stone and Abigail Adams. So they had on the full petticoats, probably didn't have a bone corset on or, you know, necessarily the same rigmarole. But I asked them how heavy the clothing was, and they said it was very heavy. So
the average weight of clothing that a woman wore on the Chilkoot Trail in 1899, 40 pounds total.
Wow. Unbelievable. Plus they were carrying other stuff.
That's an honest to God statistic I looked up one time for something I wrote.
Okay.
So take that to the bank. Yep. 40 pounds, can you imagine? You know, I have a water filter, and it requires 40-pound bags of salt. And every time I pick one of those things up, I can barely do it. And I'm thinking, I can't believe that these women hiked over the Chilkoot Pass in this, plus everything else that they were carrying on their back.
Precisely.
And then went back for more.
Yes.
And the lack of hygiene, too. And, you know, walking across dirt roads in mud, and some of the nurses that went into the fields, they said that their dresses were so filled with blood they had to squeeze them out. Just day-to-day life, it must have been horrendous.
Just trying to keep yourself clean. And their definition, well, I mean, and down through the years, it would change, but their definition of clean, what we thought of, and we think of as clean, and what they thought of as clean, probably vastly different.
Right. And I think that, you know, following women's fashions is an indication of freedoms gained. So certainly by, you know, turn of the century, the early 1900s, women started wearing less and less, and the flapper era came into fashion. And, you know, again, you always have that segment of the population that's appalled. Deb's just paging through the book, and so some of the photographs, but the women that are lined up at the beach, and for the first time skin is showing when women were going into the water, certainly a far away from today's, you know, thong or bikinis, but still, just every step along the way, how much, you know, freer women would become, but, you know, a whole segment of the population.
This is sort of on topic, but did you, either one of you, see the film about Coco Chanel?
No.
No.
There's you should see it just for one scene. There's a scene where she goes to the beach with her boyfriend, and she's wearing her clothes, which are made out of lightweight jersey, and they're not really form-fitting. They're sort of loose, and she looks so comfortable. And she's the only person dressed like that when everyone else is dressed in Edwardian gear, and you know they're all corseted to a fare-thee-well, and they have these huge, elaborate hats, and they're carrying parasols, and they have gloves on and high-button boots, and you know it took three maids to get them into all that outfit, you know, and she pulled her top over her head and pulled her skirt up over her feet, and she was good to go.
Yes, yeah, very telling, right?
The only thing in fashion I'd like to see are hats. I like hats.
Well, I see them on people who look good in hats. You can bring them back, Deb.
Sometimes I do. But hats are okay in my book.
She had one on when she was Margaret Sanger, and I think you're hooked. So most history books do not talk about things like women dealing with menstruation, and Collins talks about the diaries of the women going west, and, you know, that was another thing that they would not write about that. And again, you try to imagine, what do those women have to do to manage that whole part of their lives while they're traveling across to the west?
There would be no privacy.
No. So again, of course, they assume it was rags, but they wondered if they used plants or things like the Native Americans did. So I just thought that was, and again, another.
Well, I mean, think of those long dry spells across the West, where, you know, there wouldn't be water for, you know, probably days, maybe even weeks, except what they carried with them, and that they reserved for, you know, drinking and cooking and watering the livestock, too.
Yep.
And, you know, so, I mean, oh, God, I can't even imagine the squalor.
You know, in thinking about that topic, I that was one of my early thoughts when I was reading about pregnancy and other aspects of women coming over on the boats, and I thought, what did they do? But the lack of not having anything written about that, I don't think is very strange, in that I don't think any one of us here, if we were going to record an event that occurred, would necessarily include that as part of one of our struggles, because it's just part of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's.
And we deal with it. Yeah.
And you deal with it. Yeah.
Just deal with it. So, and that was a quote. Some of the theme we've been talking about here is, you know, level of cleanliness and what they had available anyway to make themselves more clean. And so the quote from Collins was, for homemakers, the greatest boon was water.
I believe it.
I could appreciate that.
Okay, well,
you read that book and you walk around your house, you know, and you're sitting in a chair at home and you're reading that book and you've got clothes in the washer and you hear the washer switch to spin and you think to yourself, have I got it lucky or what?
Exactly. So I'm just going to ask this question with quick answer. If you had to pick another era to live in, which would it be?
Oh, I was, my introduction to women's lives was with the ladies of Seneca Falls. And I have been enamored with them. I think I would have loved to hang out with Elizabeth Cady and Susan B. and just kind of have conversations with them and walk right up to suffrage movement. That would be my spot.
Good spot. You'd have 40 pounds of clothing on. But Dana, how about you?
Advantage, because you'd have to.
Do you have any?
I wouldn't, Judy.
I'm not going.
For women, this era, especially in this country, is the best by far. I won't even indulge in the fantasy. I could, however, be persuaded to wish for the resurrection of Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, okay. So I want to thank Dana and Deb for joining me today as we talked about America's Women by Gail Collins. Next month, we will be reading and discussing Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us by Murray Carpenter. Joining me is Winona Benson from the Cooperative Extension Service and Lisa Boyles. I also want to remind listeners that 89.5 is a community radio station that relies on support from listeners like you. So please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing member. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club, and happy reading. Thank you.
The Radio Book Club is supported by the Read Alaska Award Program at Fireside Bookstore in downtown Palmer.